I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, as well as the regular updates and news, we bring you an honest and searing account of warfare, captivity, and freedom from former British soldier and Ukrainian Marine, Sean Pinner.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Wednesday, 27th of March. 2 years and 32 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today, I'm joined by our associate editor, Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor, Francis Dernley, senior foreign correspondent, Roland Oliphant, and our guest is Sean Pinner. A warning for our listeners, this episode contains graphic descriptions of violence and of physical and mental torture. I started by asking Dom for the latest updates from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. So another busy day, although very notable that for, what is it now, second or third day running, the wave of air attacks is not what it was from Russia. Anyway, let's dive in. So Ukrainian forces say they have repelled 21 attacks on the Novopapilivka front. That's just the west of Donetsk city. This comes from Kyiv's general staff. However, they do say of particular concern is the settlement of Novomykolaivka. That's about 20 k's southwest of Donetsk city centre. Russian ground troops and aircraft have focused the majority of their efforts in the last 24 hours in that area, repeatedly attempting to breach Ukrainian defences. Russian forces are thought to control up to about half of the settlement. This comes from the ISW, Institute for the Study of War in the US. And when we say settlement, again, this is an area I've been chatting with a few people online. I mean, it's a Ukrainian phrase, which seems to mean everything from small village up to medium-sized towns, not cities. But yeah, I mean, settlement does, I think, to many Western ears, sound like just a few houses. But I think in Ukrainian terms, it's village up to town size. Anyway, the Ukraine general staff said in total, the enemy carried out 4 missile strikes, 52 airstrikes and 43 shelling attacks on the position of our troops and settlements. Now, there have been more Russian airstrikes overnight on Kharkiv. Sumy also came under heavy fire yesterday with at least 180 explosions across the region. That comes from the local administration there. 13 Shahed drones were fired at Ukraine overnight. So only 13, not good, but only 13 compared to the numbers we saw last week. That is massively down. 10 were shot down over Kharkiv, Sumy and near Kyiv. Now, in a border area, Russia said that its air defence systems had shot down 18 rockets near the border city of Belgorod. That has been an area of increased activity of late. Belgorod governor said one person was wounded there. Now, what's becoming a hot topic, thanks in no small part, really, to the work of Francis Farrell, our friend at the Kyiv Independent and the guys at Objective Ukraine. Ukraine says it has dug miles of trenches in Kherson Oblast to bolster its defences against Russian attacks. Oleksandr Prokudin, Kherson's military chief, posting on Telegram, said, "There are kilometres of anti-tank trenches and non-explosive barriers. We are building this second line of defence in Kherson Oblast. We are doing this with one goal in mind, to protect the already liberated territories." Now, footage of the trenches posted on social media show quite a web of deep furrows carved into barren fields with vast quantities of earth piled up nearby. Now, I would say that is a good start, but should not be the finished product. I mean, I look at that and I think, do those trenches have overhead cover and properly revetted sides, i.e. sides that have been bolstered with ideally sheets of metal or wood, but something to hold the sides up to prevent the trenches collapsing if a shell lands nearby? I'm looking at them, I'm thinking, are those positions mutually supporting? So you can support, you can bring fire down onto enemy attacking some of your colleagues, and likewise, you can be supported if it's happening to you. Have they made proper efforts to conceal them? And I don't think they have. If the Earth is just piled up nearby, that's very obvious from the air. Now, it might be a work in progress, but you should get rid of all that Earth and cover it over with the turf that you've dug up. Or if the whole place is just one big muddy heap, that doesn't necessarily matter. But you should do more to conceal the position rather than just try and paint everything. Unless the whole thing's part of a big deception plan, and that's what they want Russia to see. But I don't think that is the case. So I think this is a good start, but not what a proper defensive position should look like. I talk more about this stuff in this week's Defence in Depth film, which we filmed it this morning, is out tomorrow, about fortifications. Anyway, President Zelensky, you may remember, announced earlier this month that the Ukraine's military is on track to construct over 1,200 miles of defensive fortifications aimed at keeping the Russian advance at bay. But there is defensive fortifications and then there are just holes in the ground, and they're not necessarily the same thing. Right, next one. Kyiv's prosecutor general has said that more than 10,000 Ukrainian civilians are being held by Russia. More than 5,600 of them have been subjected to torture. Andrei Kostin, speaking to Interfax Ukraine, said there are different figures. We estimate tens of thousands, more than 10,000 for sure. We are talking only about those who were forcibly relocated, not about those who made this decision at their own discretion. As for the victims of torture, Mr. Kostin said the true figures may be much higher, adding that 164 Russian torture chambers and forced detention centres have been discovered in liberated Ukrainian territories. Linked to that, a report came out last night, I think, a report by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, the OHCHR, you'll see it around, was released yesterday. This report says that at least 32 Ukrainian prisoners of war, POWs or PWs in British military parlance, but means the same thing, 32 prisoners of war recently captured by Russia have been executed between December the 1st last year and the end of February this year. Now, reports of Ukrainian prisoners of war being tortured or killed while in Russian captivity have been surfacing since the start of the full-scale invasion. As of late February, Ukraine's prosecutor general's office that I've just mentioned, they said 19 criminal investigations were underway regarding the execution of 45 Ukrainian POWs. Now, those stats are separate from the UN report, but I mention it for context. This UN report, just because it is damning, so it's important to try and get an idea of how much weight to put on it. First of all, the methodology. They base their information on 74 field visits, 20 to places of detention, and 10 visits to care institutions or shelters. They also went to 29 trial hearings and conducted 767 interviews with victims and witnesses of human rights violations, as well as relatives and lawyers, government representatives, and members of the civil society. They looked at court documents, official records, and other material, including open sources. So the UN team interviewed 60 Ukrainian soldiers released from Russian captivity. And after that, they recorded 12 cases of executions of at least 32 people. So 32 people, 12 separate events, if you like. The report says OHCHR, so that's the Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights, has verified 3 of these incidents in which Russian servicemen executed 7 Ukrainian servicemen hors de combat. Hors de combat means when you are no longer able to take part in combat, either because you are wounded or you've been detained. So you're not a functioning soldier, even if you are still on the field of battle. The report carries on. Their accounts confirmed the previously documented facts of widespread torture, inhuman or degrading treatment and punishment of Ukrainian POWs in Russian captivity, as well as detention conditions that do not comply with international law. The report goes on, OHCHR continued to have regular access to Russian POWs in territory under Ukrainian control and interviewed 44 of them, including during a visit to a newly established POW camp in the Vinnytsia region. OHCHR acknowledges the continued efforts of the government of Ukraine to provide conditions of internment in official facilities compliant with international standards. However, OHCHR also received credible allegations of instances of torture and ill-treatment of Russian POWs committed in transit places after their evacuation from the battlefield. Just one final one from the report. It says, in occupied territory, Russian authorities continued imposing Russian political, legal and administrative systems in violation of their obligations as an occupying power. Contrary to the prohibition, in international humanitarian law against compelling inhabitants to swear allegiance to the occupying power, the Russian authorities systematically exerted pressure on residents to acquire Russian Federation citizenship and passports and to engage in other patriotic, in quote, sort of bunny ears, other patriotic activities to demonstrate loyalty to the occupying power. So it does seem, I mean, it's very difficult. They say that they've verified nearly 11,000 civilians been killed since the full-scale invasion. It is very difficult for them to get first-hand account of Ukrainian prisoners of war in Russia. They can only hear when people have come back. There's obviously that health warning that they totally acknowledge themselves. But I think it is a useful contribution to their work. I'm very critical of the UN in other areas, as you know, but I think it's something like this that does seem, the methodology to me seems sound, and the conclusions are quite stark. But there's many holes to pick in it, but I think it's a useful contribution. Anyway, next one. An assassination campaign possibly run by Kyiv security services has killed more than a dozen Ukrainian citizens collaborating with the Kremlin in Russian-occupied territory. This comes from Ukraine's spy chief, Lieutenant General Vasyl Malyuk, who is the head of the SBU, the Ukrainian Security Service. He said that since the full-scale invasion, secret operatives have targeted very many individuals responsible for attacks against Ukrainian citizens working deep behind enemy lines, including inside Russia. He claimed the assassination campaign run through networks of secret agents has prioritised Ukrainian nationals collaborating with Moscow to arrest and torture other Ukrainians, but that formally Kyiv cannot take responsibility for the killings. He was speaking in an hour-long interview with ICTV, the national broadcaster. He said, officially, we will not admit to this, which I think he might just have done, but then says, but at the same time, I can offer some details. General Malyuk went on to list in precise detail how several pro-Kremlin officials were killed, including, in few instances, the calibre of the bullet and the exact weight of explosives used. So, yeah, I think he's given a few details there, unless it is all a deception plan, as I say. Maybe I'm just paranoid, don't know. And then just finally for me, the European Union has delivered 500,000 shells, artillery ammunition shells, to Kyiv. Comes from Josep Borrell, the EU's chief diplomat. He said he was speaking as he renewed the promise to provide 1 million shells by the end of this year. It was originally the end of last year, but they've changed it now to the end of this year. He said, we have donated 500,000 artillery shells to Ukraine. By the end of the year, it will be more than 1 million. Now, on top of that, on top of the 1 million, another 400,000 shells are going to be provided through commercial contracts with the European defence industry, Mr. Borrell added. He said the Czech initiative to buy ammunition outside the EU comes in addition to these efforts. That's the Czech initiative that's going to seek to buy 800,000 shells, with various countries putting money in the pot for that. However, Mr. Borrell stressed that Europe providing the shells it has promised Ukraine by the end of the year is, what he said, a minimum requirement. It is far from being enough, and we have to increase both our capacity of production and the financial resources devoted to support Ukraine, he said. Okay. Good, that's good. Nice one. Words are easy. I will only give Mr. Borrell the full thumbs up when they are delivered, David. But at least for now, they're saying the right things. We can hold them to account later. That's us up to date, David.
Thank you very much, Dom. Francis Sternley, what's been across your desk this morning?
Well, thanks, David. It's been an open question ever since the Moscow concert hall attack as to the degree to which the Kremlin itself believes that Kyiv is somehow responsible, as it says publicly, versus it using that as a deliberate deflection tool from their own failures on stopping the attack. This is a really important question because there is evidence that when regimes whip themselves into a frenzy at times at war, they begin to believe their own lies. In the Russian context, one need only look at the paranoia that festered during the Cold War in the Soviet Union when they came to believe their own exaggerated narratives about external threats and internal stability. Some welcome news, therefore, if true, that reason and facts do still have some weight among Russian elites comes in a report from Bloomberg that many of Putin's close allies refused to believe his claim that Ukraine was involved in the terrorist attack. Citing four people with close ties to the Kremlin, it says Kremlin officials were shocked by the failure of the security services to prevent Friday's massacre, and that barely anyone within Russia's political or business elite believes Ukraine was behind the attack. According to one source, Putin was present at discussions where officials agreed there is no connection to Kyiv, yet the president remains determined to use the tragedy to try and rally Russians behind the war. Now, it is important to stress in that context that the tentacles of Russian propaganda travel far beyond Russia itself, even within Russian expat communities living in the West. Many listeners will have seen the footage of people lining up Russian embassies to vote, with some quite gladly saying they voted for Putin when asked in the queue by journalists. I know many will find it extraordinary that people can enjoy the benefits of a NATO country, including access to a free press, and still openly repeat Russian propaganda narratives. One listener passed on that in one Norwegian town, Putin allegedly got more than 80% of the votes, and in the capital, Oslo, over 50%. I'd welcome more research on this phenomenon, and if anyone knows of any, please do reach out to me via Twitter or the usual address. Now, another narrative the Kremlin seems keen to peddle is anti-Semitism, with Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, when asked how Zelensky would be linked to the Moscow terror attack, as he claims, replied, "Well, there is a particular kind of Jew over there, a Jew who in many ways shows sympathy and inclination to the nationalist spirit that has permeated the leadership of the Kyiv regime." The insinuation there seems to be that Jewish people ought not to be expected to be loyal to their own country, one of the oldest anti-Semitic tropes. But turning to the West now, a very interesting and important piece of insight reported again in Bloomberg that Emmanuel Macron infuriated US officials by hinting that NATO troops could be deployed in Ukraine. As listeners will know, the French president last month refused to rule out putting boots on the ground in Ukraine, a move that senior US officials say risks triggering direct conflict with Moscow, according to one official familiar with the matter. Mr. Macron's comments were designed to keep the Kremlin guessing, but officials familiar with NATO discussions on Ukraine said they may have had the opposite effect, according to the report. By forcing Berlin to publicly rule out the possibility of sending troops, Macron managed to dispel what living ambiguity there had been about the whereabouts of allies' red lines, it reported. Meanwhile, from an operational standpoint, the comments risked jeopardising several countries who already quietly had some personnel in Ukraine, separate officials reported. So that is apparently Washington's perspective on Macron's remarks. But I think, if I may say, it's a rather ungenerous reading. After all, Moscow was already very much aware that countries had personnel in Ukraine and was also very intimate with where Germany's red lines are. What Macron managed to do, consciously or not, was move the conversation into a different space, which I would argue, alongside many others, is especially vital for the months ahead, namely where the red lines are and making it clear to the Kremlin that there are some countries who would consider putting boots on the ground in certain extreme scenarios. That's not just France. There are other countries, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, who have also articulated that. For Washington to privately condemn this, therefore, is, I would argue, unhelpful for achieving their stated aims of supporting Ukraine, as it is becoming increasingly clear that Kyiv requires more support, not less, than it is currently receiving. And if that cannot come in the form of weapons, it must come in the form of policy shifts, i.e. making commitments Moscow dare not cross, given that we know Moscow operates in the political space that is afforded to it. Fundamentally, as I said last week, even if Joe Biden wins the presidency in November, there needs to be a recognition that Washington is unlikely to go further in its support of Ukraine. We hear that from very, very senior officials offline. Therefore, if European nations are really to stand by their commitments to Ukraine, then they will have to step up themselves in terms of weapons and in terms of political commitments. So this is a really fundamental area, this, and one we will continue to return to, because fundamentally there is a gap in understanding about what is needed, I would argue, between certain European nations and Washington. And with the reliance that there is or has been on Washington, more is going to have to be done by European nations if they are to stand by their commitments, as I say. Now, turning to Ukraine specifically, just wanted to give a very quick update on the ongoing grain war, as is often articulated. Kyiv's agriculture minister has said that the Franco-Polish drive to increase curbs on Ukrainian food imports into the EU risks prolonging Russia's war. He said that the additional restrictions designed to placate farmers taking part in protests against EU rules would hit Kyiv's revenues, adding that 80% of the problems that are usually connected to Ukrainian exports do not exist. They are imaginary. And for listeners who are interested in this, I recommend you listen to yesterday's episode if you missed it, where I summarised a very interesting article in Politico, which shows in detail, really, with graphs, how much of the so-called grain war is caused by Russia's export strategy, as opposed to Ukrainian grain, as it's often perceived as. So an interesting subject. But lots going on, David, and I know we've got more to unpack with Roland, and very interested to hear Sean's reflections on the POW's issues later on.
Well, thank you very much, Francis and Dom. As Francis said, let's go to Roland first and then to Sean. Thank you so much, Sean, for waiting so patiently. Roland, not a brief update, but just one story to cover. You've been looking at some interesting news on potential developments in the war on the Russian side. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I just thought I'd flag this. So Medusa and the independent Russian language outlet put out quite an interesting piece yesterday, just after we recorded yesterday's podcast. It's basically speaking to four people close to the Russian government. They say their sources are two Kremlin insiders, a source in the government or the presidential administration, and a high-ranking member of United Russia. And it looks like a report that began as a kind of, what are we going to expect from Putin's fifth, that obviously was then overtaken by events at Kroger City Hall. But it's interesting remarks. I mean, the first one seems to be that there's a consensus that the Kroger City Hall attacks aren't necessarily going to change many of Putin's priorities. You can see that the quote is, currently the top leadership isn't articulating clear decisions, just reassuring citizens. There's an established formula, avoid making sudden moves if possible. And that kind of fits with the reporting from Bloomberg that Francis just referred to yesterday, that says that Bloomberg's own sources, and I would put a lot of store by that. Bloomberg has a good record of decently placed sources quite close to the Russian government talking on sensitive things, saying that basically inside the government, no one really believes that Ukraine was behind it, but a decision appears to have been made to pin this on Ukraine because that's the convenient thing to do. And by the way, you can see that in today's Russian papers. If you look at Moscow Pravda, probably the biggest selling Russian tabloid, the headline is about the West being behind it. Argumenti Fakti, really extraordinary front page with pictures of Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, and Volodymyr Zelensky, and Joe Biden, and a headline basically saying, we know who inspired that attack. So that decision's clearly been made. This is going to be pinned officially by the Russian government on Ukraine, if there was any doubt about that at all. But coming back to this Medusa piece, so these insiders have put the question to him, what do you expect from his coming term? They mostly say nothing is going to change. There's going to be continued repressions at home. He's going to continue the war. And they all seem to say that Putin's priority remains the war. But then the question becomes, okay, what are his objectives now? And there's a bit of a division here. One of these sources says, after the failure of the counteroffensive, Putin perceives Ukraine as weak and is ready to go all the way to victory, even to Kyiv, no matter what the cost. If he needs to call for mobilization, he'll call for mobilization. If he needs to put the economy further onto a war footing, he'll do that. This is actually the interesting thing that caught my eye. So I'll just read it out, the paragraph actually. In contrast, another source close to the administration believes Putin has, quote, more realistic goals, namely capturing Kharkiv and then concluding the special military operation. So we know Vladimir Putin has stated that you need a buffer zone to protect Belgorod. And you may remember that a few days ago, the independent Russian outlet Veska reported that the Kremlin is considering a mobilization of 300,000 men specifically for attack on Kharkiv. And I've just looked through our own reporting. I think back in January, Joe Barnes was reporting concerns about another Russian push on Kharkiv. So I think this is what caught my eye. I think there's clearly a drumbeat here, and it's worth really paying attention to that particular part of the front. Is that what they're going to do? The other interesting comment in this piece regarding that is like, look, the decision on mobilization, that depends on what happens at the front. One of these sources is saying like Crocus doesn't really come into it. So everything's ready for the mobilization if it's decided that they need it. And we've talked a lot about how the Kremlin may exploit the Crocus attack to justify it. But remember, we were talking about the likelihood of a new wave of mobilization after the election long before that. So that's the basic takeaway. Keep an eye on Kharkiv, continuation of the war, and probably a determined effort by the Kremlin to blame the West, turn the hatred around, the hatred and the anger and the thirst for revenge around the Crocus attack against the West and Ukraine, but essentially make sure that it doesn't interfere with the main priority, which is pursuit of the war.
Thank you so much, Dom, Francis and Roland. Sean Pinner is a former British soldier and Ukrainian Marine. During the full-scale invasion, he fought for Ukraine at the Siege of Mariupol. He was captured by the Russians and subjected to months of physical and mental torture. Following a show trial that handed down the death penalty, he was, months later, traded back in a prisoner exchange. We spoke to Sean about his time fighting, his experiences as a POW, and his view on how to maintain hope, even in the darkest of times. Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Could you, just for listeners who maybe haven't heard your name before, even though they should have done, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career and your life over the past few years?
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's my pleasure. I'm former British military, Bosnia and Northern Ireland I'd served in. I'm SEER trained as well, which is Survival Evasion Resistance Escape trained. I did that in America just before a second deployment to Bosnia and Croatia. I'm a former Ukrainian Marine, a former National Guard instructor of Ukraine, section commander, BTR commander, first foreigner to command a position on the front lines in Ukraine. I would pass the Marines Berry test, one of the first foreigners to do that, not just a foreigner, but one of the oldest guys to do that. I passed all aspects of Ukrainian parachute training with 4 combat jumps, 1 night jump, 9 in total. Married to Ukrainian, lived in Mariupol since 2018. I have legal status, legal residency in Ukraine, pay my taxes in Ukraine. And now I talk about my experiences at the hands of the Russians to NATO troops and most NATO countries. Also try and keep Ukraine in the public eye on social media, do some charity work. And I've written a book as well about my experience. So I've been busy since my exchange.
Well, tell us about the full-scale invasion. What did you do? Where did you fight?
On the day of the full-scale invasion, I was about 800 metres forward of the first line. I was in a listening post trying to identify positions where the Russians or the DPR would fire artillery, mortars, locate them, pass them back to my command post to then launch a counter-battery onto those positions. And I was deployed December the 12th, 2021. So I was already in the trenches 2 or 3 months before the full-scale invasion. And we, like I said, this was my third or fourth tour on the front line in Ukraine, defending my city where I had a house on the left bank in Mariupol, about 25 minutes, 30 minutes from my position, funnily enough. So from my front room, you could actually hear the shelling and them shelling the positions on the front lines, the DPR, the Russians. So, you know, for me, it was about defending my city. And on that opening day, it was the most intense fighting I'd ever seen, you know, as a soldier. It was real shock and all stuff. Grad, artillery, SBGs, RPGs. And also the Russians had full air superiority. So all we had was surface-to-air igloos that weren't cutting the mustard, so to speak. And we're pretty bad at shooting the plane. So we really had nothing to combat that, essentially. Also, a couple of weeks before the invasion, the technology changed, the drones become better. They were able to drop ordnance at night. Suddenly the drones had thermal. In 5 years, we hadn't seen that. 2 days before the invasion, I was teaching guys how to use the NLAW. And I was the only one that had any experience in firing it, the Law 94, some 25, 30 years ago, which positively made me a Gandalf when trying to teach them 2 or 3 days before the invasion how to use NLAW. I found myself Googling a PDF of the optic systems of the new NLAW and then relaying that information to my guys. And then we pulled back to, did a several day pullback fighting withdrawal back to Mariupol. I mean, for us, 2 weeks before the invasion, they were already starting to bomb the villages behind us and try to get behind our positions in Pavlopol, which was about 15, 20 minutes outside Mariupol. And so for us, I mean, it wasn't February the 24th, it had already started. And that's how we ended up going back into Mariupol over a period of several days.
Can you tell us about how the battle for Mariupol, then the siege of Mariupol, went for you and your men?
Well, after several days, I had to make a choice whether I was going to be overt or covert. Largely for 4 or 5 years, nobody knew who I was. But the journalist had pulled out from Mariupol quite early, a week before the invasion, and pulled out to safer areas. But I really had a block on any sort of news from February the 24th because of the jamming, and the Russians were taking out the mobile masts. And so we really didn't have any news for several days until I got back into Mariupol. Then my phone started beep, 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 and everything, just 200 messages came through all at the same time. So I really had to really catch up with the information and make a decision whether I was going to sort of tell the world what was happening in Mariupol, or whether I was going to still stay under the radar. But I made the choice to broadcast on a channel in UK who asked me to do some footage. And unfortunately, the antennas went up in Russia once I did that. But for several weeks, we dug in and we held out. And command and control was good up until the point we, around sort of April, we were getting smashed constantly in Mariupol. I remember the day when the theatre got blew up. My platoon sergeant just sort of came around and said, they've blown the theatre up. And so it was pretty intense. We were already running out of food and water at that point. So by April, we were really down to our bare bones, lost 60% of our platoon, 3 BTRs got taken out. My best friend Dima and Ivanov and a few others were killed. But 60% of our guys were injured through shrapnel. I mean, drones were coming into our position, flying 10 feet above the ground, looking in through doors and windows, trying to find us. It was something out of Terminator. And when I joined the army, we didn't even have phones in the 90s, you know. And now we're looking at drones coming in, all different types of drones. It's like Heathrow Airport over Mariupol at the time. So we were down to our bare bones. And then we got the order so that we would be trying to join up with the sister battalion on the Azov coast who were fighting the Russians there. And it was about 130 kilometers away. And really, I thought that was quite ambitious at the time. So around the sort of 11th or the 12th of April, we got the nod to go. Unfortunately, it was cancelled the first time because there were Russian BMPs on the road going out. By this time, they were 30, 50 metres away from us. It was like I describe it as the end scenes of Saving Private Ryan. They were literally taking up positions we formerly held. They'd encircled us. I managed to get a call out to my wife and say, it's all over. And she was saying, giving me briefs and shouting me down the phone to survive and keep alive, tell the boys they're doing a great job. Something totally unexpected, really. I was expecting it to break down. But while we were trying to break out the next day, in the early hours of the morning, we were ambushed. I got split up from my platoon. There were casualties everywhere. And I was captured about 2 hours outside of Mariupol by DPR forces. I'd already planned to start an escape invasion. And when it all went wrong, and then I'd made a decision to then try and escape to friendly lines, which was about 200, 250 kilometres, which is quite tough going at my age. Plus, we'd not had any food or water, and start an escape invasion back to friendly lines when we all got split on the ambush.
Sean, could you tell us a little bit about that moment of capture, if that's okay with you? What actually happens? What could you talk us through it?
Well, on SEER training, I'm always taught that the initial capture is the hardest and the most dangerous because it's so unpredictable. I'd already started to plan, cut down my equipment, realise what I wanted to take with me, try and get a foothold on my location. But then I started to realise quite quickly there were so many drones. The best times I could travel was early morning and dusk. And it was very hard. The day we tried to escape was the best day we'd had all year. There was blue skies, sun was shining. I mean, the day before it was foggy. It was a really good day to go. So already the luck was not on our side. And then literally when I was moving through buildings, trying to avoid the drones and being seen, I'd come to a crest of a hill in a village and walked pretty much 30 metres away from a DPR forward observation unit. I mean, we're trying to avoid and get through that first line. But every soldier takes up their positions in dead ground and strip woods. And it's very hard to do when you haven't got a drone. And I'd already planned that if I was captured, I'd try and surrender to a Russian officer, which really didn't work out for me. And also, when I was captured, they gave me a warning shot initially, which I'm only assuming they knew I was coming in. Somebody had seen me. And then I had to make a decision to ditch my phone and ditch stuff before I had to do the dreaded walk 30 metres. I was severely outnumbered in broad daylight. And if I'd tried to run away down a hill, I think they would have just cut me down. So I think I made the right decision. I certainly don't have any regrets about it. There was not much I could really do. And then my whole war changed. I had to fight in another way. And when I went to the position where they were quite well dug in, I wasn't captured. I was then mugged. They started to take all my valuables and my belt. And what I realized then was I had a lot of gear on that most Ukrainians couldn't afford. So it was very, I wasn't going to get through any filtration process because of the Russian I do know, because I'd learned Russian in my 5 years, not Ukrainian, because I lived in Mariupol. So the Russian I did know wasn't good enough to get me through tactical questioning because I speak Russian with a Cockney accent. So they're going to be very quick to pick up on that straight away. So I knew I would be of someone of interest. And unfortunately, they took me to a company location where I was basically handed from the DPR to Russian regulars. And how do I know they were Russian regulars? Because they had full Russian fatigues. They had all the Gucci gear, gangster grips, PMAGs, optics, chem lights. And the DPR forces are just mismatched. They're really bad with three different types of camouflage. They don't look like soldiers as such, but these guys were the real deal, which then I thought were Spetsnaz. And they proceeded to torture me straight away, stabbed me in the leg to stop me from running anywhere. And then took me back to what I call a tiled room where the floor was all tiled with a drainage hole in the middle, strapped me to a chair. And then before they'd said anything, they electrocuted me with what I think is a tappet, because they kept referring to, do you want to phone home? Which a tappet, for those that don't know, is a field phone that could be easily adapted as a torture weapon, which is portable. They're everywhere. And I was electrocuted 3 or 4 times in the chair, beaten up. At one point, I was made to stand up and then cattle prodded. I was pistol whipped. I had a mock execution. And then I was taken to a black site, but I had an understanding of Russian. Nobody really asked me about whether I could speak Russian, but I understood that I was going to be moved on. So as long as I didn't die of a heart attack, then really I knew I was being moved on somewhere else. And my training, some sort of 30 years ago, had prepared me well. It hadn't really moved on from there, the training period. So my aim was to get through that first initial capture without scratch. And unfortunately, I was stabbed in the leg. I couldn't escape anywhere. I couldn't move anywhere. And then one electric shock just completely whacks you. You really just dribble in and your spasms. You're still shaking afterwards. The next day, my legs had inflated. I was bleeding from my capillaries. And then I was taken to a black site in Donetsk, where I was then given the good cop, bad cop. So I was then taken there where they stitched up the wound they just stabbed me in the leg with, told me that I would find discomfort at this place. And it was only later when we got our indictments that I realised that I was captured on the 13th of April. But the indictments ran from the 18th and the 19th of April. So for that time, I was just beaten, electrocuted again on the ear, made to fill out an autobiography of my time in Ukraine. And then because I'd not provided all the information they wanted, they said they were going to starve me. And for 60 days, I just had a small piece of bread every morning and that was it. The water was sort of different shades of yellow with parasites in. And you would get bread at 10 o'clock in most mornings. But if you were pulled out for propaganda just before you got your bread, you didn't eat for the day. And I had 3 or 4 days at those early stages while I was being brought out for propaganda, not eating, and then being forced to sit in front of people like Russia Today, RT, and journalist Roman Kazarov, who's quite frequently on RT, who I wasn't given a choice. I was just hooded in the black site, taken to another location. And when the hood was lifted off, he was there. And of course, my trainer in Syria would tell me to exploit those situations because we weren't being fed. I'd already done 7 weeks fighting in Mariupol. So I was already emaciated anyway. So now we weren't being fed. I had to really exploit that situation. And my aim with them was just to get on TV to tell the world I was there. But quite quickly, they were very well organized in the fact that they made it very clear to us that we would ring home once we were on the books and do video calls to Boris Johnson. And as long as we cooperated, then we wouldn't have it too bad. But the very people that were actually doing the torturing and the interrogations were behind the camera. So the journalists would be just laughing and joking with the people that were actually beating us and electrocuting us, which is very hard to deal with. I mean, it's dehumanizing and you know, takes everything away from you. All your humanity is ripped from you. But for me, the training really helped me because it gave me focus. If I could just get my face out there, even if it went onto Russian TV, I would know somebody would be watching that. And then they would know that I'm alive, which was really my main aim.
Sean, thank you so much for sharing all of that. How could you tell us a little bit more about how you dealt with this mentally? How did you get through this absolutely abhorrent treatment? What kind of techniques were you using? What were you thinking of?
Again, you've got to remember, I was with guys like NGOs who didn't know any Russian, who didn't really understand the military or the predicament they were in. So for me, I had to become a bit of a sounding board for people. And I couldn't talk to people about my background because they would interrogate, if you went off the propaganda, they would interrogate the guys in your cell to see what you told them. So you couldn't really talk to anybody in your cell about what you'd done and where you'd been. But I knew quite early that I was probably one of the only guys that had any training in this. Especially, I could anticipate situations better because I could understand Russian. I sort of knew what was going on, and I would try and get snippets from news bulletins, radios, notice boards, watches, time, trying to keep track of time. And then that became my obsession, really, that kept me busy. So I was able to then teach other guys bits of Russian, learn key words. I was doing virtual shopping trips. Because for a large part of the time, I was in an isolation cell, 1 meter by 3 meter cell with a buzzer that wakes you up in the morning and a buzzer that puts you to bed, no window, the lights on 24 hours a day. And the unpredictability of the guards was a massive problem because they would hit you on the elbows, the knees, the ankles. And they would beat you up, which told me we had some sort of value. So I was always keeping hope in mind that we would have some sort of value, that we would be exchanged. And all I had to do was keep going. And obviously, my community, I'm married. I thought about my wife quite a bit and my home. Don't get me wrong, everybody goes through ups and downs, but we sort of called it the weight between us all. When I eventually met the rest of the guys, when we were changed to prison just before the trial, we sort of nicknamed it the weight, and we knew what everybody was feeling, because even the most motivated person, so you know, at some point they were at rock bottom. So we clubbed together as a group and kept the gallows humour going. We made chessboards out of bottle tops. They would give us nothing. So we had to just make our own entertainment, essentially. And my obsession just became about what's going to happen next and try and anticipate the next move by the Russians. Because most of the time, we were just trying to get through the day. Where can we get food? Where can we get the least resistance? Or, you know, how can we get through without getting beaten up? Because if you get a broken leg in captivity or in the prison, the chances are you're not going to get that fixed. The medical side of it is very bad. So it wasn't very good. And we can't just leave the prison and go to a hospital. So you just have to get through every day without getting injured, really.
Sean, tell us about the trial and how did you get out? What happened?
Well, there's a misconception that torture they use is really to get truth through pain. And that's proven not to work. And it doesn't really work. But the Russians don't use torture in that way. They use it because they want you to say, I am guilty at the trial. And I learned that afterwards. And that's a very effective way to get you to say, I am guilty, by giving you electric shocks, starving you, beating you senseless. So they're very good at that. And that was really all they wanted me to do, because they never really asked me the tactical question that I thought would come. It was, you know, they didn't really push the facts and ask me if I knew Russian. And really, it was about the trial and the show. And that was pretty evident when we pleaded not guilty and they stopped the trial. And they stopped the trial because we had a 50-minute recess because they didn't like that we were saying not guilty. We had a defense lawyer that was initially given to me, they said would give to me, never actually came and took a statement from me. And by the time we got to the trial, it had changed to a woman. So, you know, nobody had actually come to the prison to take a statement. And they got us to ring home as well, which was really interesting because my mum was telling me that they'd actually provided the documents of our contracts and our residence to the Russian embassies. And what became apparent was that the Russians just ignored it. And we weren't mercenaries. You know, I got a legal residency. I wasn't from outside Ukraine. I lived in Ukraine. I've been living there, paying my taxes. I lived there since 2008, married to a Ukrainian. They knew that. So when we actually did go to trial, it was just a sham trial. And within 2 days, we knew what was coming. They were made us plead guilty. And the very people that guarded us in the courtroom were the people at the black side and the other prison who gave us the electric shocks and the beatings. So you could keep going down that route. But we were made to sign documents. I mean, one of the things I'm taught to see is not sign a document in a foreign language. You try doing that for 7 months and see if you keep your fingers. It just doesn't work. So these were the daily things we were going through. And we were made to say guilty. And at the end of 2 or 3 days, we were then trialed and given the death penalty, which was just a show in the courts, you know. And that's how we ended up after the trial, sort of advising the next group that have just been trialed in Russia, actually, the next group who were going to go through, don't plead guilty, plead not guilty regardless, and started to formulate a plan like a great escape. We started to fight back then. We started to get some confidence when we changed prison.
And then what happened then? So you plead not guilty, they stop the trial, and that leads eventually to your exchange. Tell us about that.
Well, in September, late September, the Queen had died. I mean, it's around the 18th of September, sort of around that date. And they came in and told us that the Queen was dead. And really, we still had fighting spirit. I mean, it was great to see that John Harding, who was a Brit that was captured with me, said, God save the King. And he's a Labour supporter, a socialist and an anti-royalist. And when I asked him about it after, he just said, I hate Russians more. So that we still had that fight, and we had, you know, everybody else, a Swede, a Moroccan, two Americans, three or four Brits, and the Ukrainians sort of saying, God save the King. And it was really good to see we still had that fight. And around the end of September, we were going on a long journey. One of the guards alluded to the fact that we could be exchanged. And then once we were exchanged, once we started from our prison in Makivka prison, David Nostrosim, 97, in Donetsk, we then went on a journey, 13-hour journey, from something like 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 9 o'clock next morning into Rostov Don. But our excitement at being exchanged was really short-lived because it was the worst journey ever. We were beaten so badly, put in a caterpillar-like stress position with a guy in front of you and then seated onto the back of the bus. So you're linked in to several other guys who were linked in by arms and tied up. And we weren't allowed to move for until sort of 9 o'clock the next morning on the... And you're sitting on a metal floor of a truck being beaten, and we weren't allowed water, we weren't allowed food. But when we got to Rostov Don, we really was just confronted by an elderly guy and his PA and lots of Saudi-looking guys, and really didn't know what was happening. But when we took off our hoods, three of the guys had lost footwear in the scuffles, all our gear, people were bleeding, an American, he looked like Homer Simpson, had tied his hood too tight to his head. And it inflated his eyes. He couldn't see. And so they then told us we were going on to a plane, which then we thought, well, we're going to get exchanged. It's great. But we didn't really know until they shut the doors of the plane and said, once we get out of Russian airspace, then you'll be free. By which time we just broke down. And it was a really emotional time. And while I was coming out of a toilet with some new clothes after a medical, this old guy was talking to me and said, where are you from? And I said, London. I said, where are you from? And he said, London. I said, you don't half look like Roman Abramovich. He said, I am Roman Abramovich. For then we just, you know, it was just shock. What are you doing here? And he explained to us what he was doing there and how he was using the proceeds of Saudi Chelsea to help the victims of war. And he was a part of our exchange along with the Prince of Saudi Arabia. And we really had no news when we did eventually get home to the UK. So because we'd had several months of just no news at all. So it was really about catching up with everything that had happened since the day of the full-scale invasion. You know, I'd sit through videos of watching the Queen's funeral and catching up on life. And my auntie had died while I was in captivity, which was terrible. And I was trying to find out what happened to all the other guys. And we're still trying to find out what's happened to people sort of 2 years on. And, you know, it was an emotional time. And that's where I come across your back catalogue of podcasts, to be fair. And, you know, thank you for doing that, because I was just listening to your podcast, an avid listener for 2 weeks, walking around, eating dinner, going back upstairs with my headphones on and just locking myself away, listening to everything that had happened.
Sean, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And I do hope we were accurate and useful and as you were catching up. May I ask, what were some of the first things you did when you knew you were free, when you were on home soil? What did it feel like when you knew that you'd never have to go back to where you were?
Well, my first thought was my friends and who was alive and who was dead. We just kept ringing around. My commander got released from me, I didn't know. And first thing you do is try and find friends and family and people you know. Did they get out? And you're really catching up with life. I'm also, you know, keeping contact with the guys I was captive with who on the Telegram channel, and we talk regularly and make sure we're all okay. My wife and my mom and my family had a story too. My friend just got released 3 weeks ago, and he's had a 2-year block out of any information. So he's really catching up with life after captivity. And we're helping them now. We help people that visit the hospital, take them cigarettes and food and vitamins. And we help people that are coming out when they're first stopped to the hospital. And we're constantly looking for friends and family still, because 60% of my wedding pictures from 4 years ago, 60% of the people in those pictures are either captured or killed. And that's just us. I use that as like a reference, really, to give you some sort of context of the families that are going through this right now. And we're still going through it. So it's not over for us. We have to deal with this every day.
Sean, can I ask, before I hand over to Dom, Francis and Roland, who I'm sure will have questions as well, you've spoken in quite a matter-of-fact way about the extraordinary violence done to you and to your friends. Could you talk to us a little bit about the process of dealing with that and rebuilding after that, now you are free?
I do, because I've talked about it a lot of times. I've written a book about it. It's very therapeutic to talk about it. And now I want to tell the world what Russia's really like. And the recent events with Crocus and the massacre in Russia has really highlighted everything I wrote about and everything I talk about. I mean, it's just, I think it's been hidden for so long. They don't really talk about it. And now it's right out in the open. I mean, it's in your face what they've done to the guys they've just captured. So now I want to talk about actually what they don't use really torture for truth finding. What they do is they want you to say guilty at the trial. And things that people probably wouldn't know, the use of torture, how they use it, propaganda. RT is a big one I'm pushing at the moment. They're complicit in our mental torture. The fact that you don't get a chance to even say, no, I don't want to talk to them, or you just get forced into it. Otherwise, you're going to lose a finger or be beaten or electrocuted. Or they can stop your food completely. So there's nothing you can really do about that. So now I sort of talk about it because it's a way of dealing with it. I mean, we had good gallows humour. I mean, it sounds really weird, but the good British humour we had amongst ourselves, I don't know what I'd be like if I'd have done it on my own. I was with a good group of people who all chipped in and all, you know, looked after each other. And that's part of coming out, part of seeing and part of training I've had. And 50 years old, I'm a better understanding of people. I did 13 years in the military, 9 war tours. I have a better understanding of people. I had a better understanding of that situation. You can imagine a 19-year-old coming out with some of the guys I served with. This was their first operations. They're never going to come back from this. So it's about supporting them and anybody who's captured, really. I teach now, I talk to people and say, if you are going to eventually get released, you have to hold your head up high and say, I did a good job. Well, we did a good job. Commander Krog didn't go down. We held Mary Oakport for as long as we could. All right, the escape and evasion didn't go to plan. But you sort of deal with each bit as it goes on. I mean, I deal with Mary Oakport because I'm just lucky to survive that with the onslaught of the bombs and artillery and mortars and the Russian air superiority and the fighting on the streets. I'm lucky to survive that when many didn't. So that for me was really hard work. The actual catch-up I had some sort of knowledge of, and now I pass on that knowledge to other people.
Sean, hi, it's Dom here. Thanks so much for joining us today. I don't really know how to respond to it. It's hugely powerful stuff. And I've spoken before about how the American Prisoner of War Association, their motto, as you probably know, is return with honour. They say everyone has their limits. Everyone's going to talk at some point. You can't put up with everything for the whole time. But the bottom line is, don't betray yourself or your friends and your family. So return with honour. And you seem to embody that, if I could say. When I was in the military, I was a conduct after capture instructor. I used to train resistance to interrogation and what have you. I've only been on the opposite side of it in exercise terms, never been through what you have. But many of the things you said as we were just chatting absolutely leapt straight out of me from the training I not only received, but then that I then passed on to others. And you mentioned yourself that training helped. I just wonder if you could talk us through where that training proved most supportive for you, in particular how you control your mind when you were being beaten and you had no certainty of the future. How did you control your mind and resist the temptation to allow the darker thoughts to dominate you?
It's quite a good question, because I talk about what led me to come to Ukraine in the first place. I'd already referred to things like the Black Cloud, and I was at a midlife crisis, but I'd probably had four before I come to Ukraine, to be fair. For me, I was never at that point of depression I was before I come to Ukraine, which sounds really weird. I had a bar that was set that I knew I didn't want to go to ever again. And I don't think at any point through the whole of Mariupol or my capture did I ever hit that bar. I felt it's while I didn't have any control, I felt I had some, because I understood that if I were going to get captured, this first bit's going to be a nightmare. And also, I could anticipate. I knew the culture out there. I knew what to say, when to say it. If I'd have said I'd worked with National Guard or Azov on the front line, I'd probably have been shot on the spot. But I knew if I could just get through that first bit and get them on the back foot, tell them I've got some of their interest, and then have to deal with each stage as it comes. I'd done SEER for me as well, so I'd done that training. For me, it was about what good is that training if I just give up? And then you, like I touched on earlier, you're with NGOs. People have had no military. You find yourself being a leader amongst a group of people, and you don't really want to stand out as being a leader when you're captured. So it's about helping, support, delay information. You're always going to talk, like you said. It's about being a bit smart and clever with it. I didn't have a cover story when I went in, but one was sort of manufactured for me. And I was always taught and said to keep it as close to the truth as you possibly can if you have a cover story. Well, for me, mine was I was an old man and married to Ukrainian and lived in Ukraine for love. And, you know, this was a way to get my citizenship. But that sort of was manufactured for me. And I stuck with that. I certainly did go. They didn't push me on my previous background in the British military. Not really. It wasn't as bad as they thought it would be. And then the small victories that we always go on about. It could be anything from just getting a spring water, cigarette. By the end of it, I didn't have a choice if I was going to the media, but I would certainly use it as an option to get food or a burger or a cigarette or some water that was clean and an opportunity to get what I needed to survive. And that's really what my time was about. What kept me occupied was, you know, trying to survive. And unfortunately, we lost Paul Urie, who was in our prison and in the next cell to us, because he was not understanding of those sorts of things, had not done SEER, wasn't military trained, didn't understand Russian, and unfortunately got beaten so badly he died of his injuries 2 days later, which, again, you have to pick yourself up from that and keep going. And in Makivka, the Ukrainians were literally, had got 4 kilometres from us, firing into the prison with artillery. We thought we were going to get liberated long before we were going to be exchanged. So we're working out, if they do blow a hole in the wall, how we're going to get out, who we're going to take, which routes are we going to take. I mean, it was constantly ongoing. And then we'd have times where we'd have boredom, 23 hours a day in a cell, which then your brain and mind just wanders. So you have to identify and be able to identify those dark times. And then that's why we named it The Wait, because if it was getting on top of you, we could say, look, I've got my wait today. And people would just start cracking jokes or trying to get you thinking of home and what are you going to do? Well, making recipes. One guy wanted to have a chicken breast, fill it with cheese, coat it in breadcrumbs and call it the baseball, the biggest chicken nugget you'd ever seen. I mean, we just had junk talk to keep us going and pick us our spirits up. So there isn't, even the motivated person is up and down. So it's about supporting everybody else and picking them up when they are at that point, when they're down, you know?
Thanks, Sean. Just one more for me, because I know the other guys want to jump in. When you talk about your SEER training, so survive, evade, resist, escape training, practical applications or practical things you can do, as well as an overarching sort of psychological approach to it. I mean, we, from the instructor side and the training, we were taught to try and separate the self-induced pressures from the system-induced pressures. So self-induced, all those dark thoughts that you can't help invading your head, and then the system-induced, which is what the people can do to you. Which did you feel was the harder to put up with?
Self-induced pressures, obviously. It did get a bit easier for me. After the trial, what can you do to someone when you've sentenced them to death? The Russians knew that too. So they just left me to cell for 2.5 months. And that became all about self-induced pressures. And some days you just talk yourself into a stupor in your head. So you have to really keep on top of that with giving yourself tasks. And they might be the most menial tasks, like cleaning the only toilet we've got. There's a right that resembles the one from Trainspotted. It's dreadful, but you know, just giving yourself a task, and you have to keep motivating yourself to identify that weight and that black cloud that comes over and stop yourself talking yourself into a stupor. Because those were the hardest months, August and September, once we'd had the trial. We didn't know if we were going to get an appeals process or we could be just pulled out that afternoon and be shot, which I later learned was being talked about after my exchange. I saw the what was being said. So those days were pretty dark and everybody knew that. But it was about identifying that. And like I said, I don't know what I'd have been like on my own, but I had good guys that were with me. And it was definitely those, especially the last parts of my captivity, were definitely the self-induced pressures that were far worse than anything else.
Sean, it's Francis here. Thank you so much for your time today. I think it's fair to say that you are a unique witness to some of the things you've described today. And what I mean by that is that you're somebody who is able to speak about them, not only because you survived, but also because, of course, you're now in the position to be able to speak about the many people in the military that we talk to are not able to be as candid as you can be. So my question really is a bit broader than your experience. It's your perspective on the differences between the Ukrainian armed forces and the Russians. We hear a lot about the Ukrainian armed forces are better in terms of how they approach fighting, that they're more adaptive and innovative. I'm very interested in your perspective on that versus what you've seen and experienced. And also I wanted to ask in relation to that, what you think Ukraine needs now in order to fight the next phase of this war from somebody who has actually fought it up close. Thank you.
I mean, I can talk from personal experience. As I said to you before, the initial technology change, Senate became more advanced. The drones capability became more advanced quite early on. So I was able to see that. I don't know as a soldier these days. I mean, I'm retired. I don't know as a soldier these days, you're going to deal with that. I mean, as I said to you, they were flying in to our compound 10 feet above the ground, looking in through windows and doors, ready probably, I assume, call in mortars and artillery. I'd seen Russians come down the same stripward to our position with 8 guys, and then 20 guys, and then 30 guys, and we would let them get 30 meters and just light them up as they came in with no baseline support, basic, no tactics involved, which I can only assume, which I, at the time I thought they were DPR because they were just dreadful. But they were willing to sacrifice waves of people then in Mariupol. But there are some good units because my friends in Mariupol have since been released told me they were, translation wise, he just said they had weapons that didn't make noises. And he said they were just coming in, and they had good tactics. So, I mean, they are there, but we were hitting in Mariupol varied capabilities because even when the mortar crew started to, and I was thinking, that's it, we're done for, the mortar crews are in, they're going to tear us apart in this position. They were quite happy to spend 2 or 3 days firing mortars at the same position on the embankment without even bracketing and without even pushing into our compounds. And I was thinking, the second day, I was thinking, there must be trying to find us, target us and fire into our position. But no, it would land in the same spot in front of our embankment, in a safe spot, which wouldn't be into our compound. And it would do that for quite a long period of time. They were solely reliant in Mariupol on air power, artillery, mobile artillery. And it was just pummeling us daily until the point where we just had nobody left. I mean, one of the battalions had gone down from 600 to 140 very, very quickly. And as I said to you, 60% of our platoon was in the hospital. So we were just getting smashed and there was nothing we could really do about it apart from just get through each day. And then the drones would come in and just pick you off in the trenches. And we had good command control. It didn't stop. They were very good at telling us and warning us off when the Russians would be coming in and how many they expected to come in and which position and where they would be coming in. So up until the 30th hour, it was very good. But I can only talk about what I hear now, Mariupol, which is we didn't have any surface-to-air missiles at the time. And that really, really showed because the Russian Air Force would do bombing runs and just eventually our defence was just silent. We had good defence and eventually they just took out the guns or the BTRs or all our hardware in Mariupol and eventually it just became silent and then we had to leave. But the Ukrainians are very adaptable. They're very quick to learn new equipment, as we've seen. At some point, I think in the future, they'll be teaching the rest of the world because they're very good at fighting Russia. Their tactics are slightly different. In my time there, they're very good at fighting for time, fighting withdrawal and drawing enemy into killing fields. They're not scared of losing ground to kill more of them. They're very good at that. But when I was there, we were doing mixed joint exercises, Sea Breeze, with the Americans, the Swedes, the Brits. So they were moving away from that centralized command at the time to decentralized command. I think the success we had in Mariupol holding out over against overwhelming odds was because of that fact that we'd starting to move away from that centralized command, and there was more trusted NCOs to be able to get the job done, which when I first got there, it just wasn't really the case. They had no value in NCOs. The platoon commander would do everything. So, but now, as the war's gone, 2 years later, and that training stopped, and you're now seeing the Ukrainian military move back to that centralized command and the way that they used to fight, which is quite sad. And they're mobilizing people that were, you know, washing cars or, you know, 6 months earlier. So it's now become about training troops. So the training is essential. You speak to Danny at Trident. I know he's a friend of mine. So the training is essential at every level here. And also, you know, the weapons, we need the ammunition. Is, you know, we had a shell shortage before. Now we're on a shell hunger. We've known about this 2-3 months. And some of the stories I hear on the front are just awful. So we need those artillery shells and a lot of them very, very quickly.
Well, thank you so much, Sean. Just one very quick question from Roland, and then we'll go to our final thoughts. Roland Oliphant.
Hello, Sean. Thanks for all this. I mean, I've listened, absolutely fascinated. I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more, as far as you know, about the other people from your Marine unit that was surrounded and captured in Mariupol. Is, you know, you seem to say that some people are still unaccounted for. Are people still in captivity? What's your understanding of what happened to everybody else?
Yeah, not a handful of us have been exchanged from my unit. Most of my battalion is still captivity. We've also got friends and colleagues and family. I mean, the Russians were taking, in my cell was a train driver from Mariupol who was a civilian. He was 19. So, you know, these, they were torturing everybody. It wasn't specifically us. They were really torturing everybody who could have a link to Ukraine. And I talked to him and he was quite released. I don't know where he went. Our community, the men in our community, some of them are still in captivity. My neighbour, my wife's friends. So it's very difficult for us at the moment because we're still scanning the news. I was going to, you know, if you asked me to do a final thought, I was going to talk about that at one of the situations for my final thought. But yeah, we still constantly look at the news every day and hope that, you know, I'm in dialogue with families. We have a group chat where we try to keep everybody up to date with information. A lot of the guys don't get to write home. Some guys have. It's one of those things. So, you know, it's very difficult for us at the moment. There are many families here who are going through the same situation. So we just have to hope, and everybody gets their hopes up when there's a prisoner exchange, and then you're trying to pick people out, and some people are lucky and joyful, which is really nice. And like my friend 2 or 3 weeks ago, I wrote a book, Mikola, he was exchanged 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we're just trying to help him get back into normal life. I mean, he's not got a house anymore or a car. His family have managed to get out of Mariupol, but, you know, he's having to start his life again, and those people are going to need a lot of support.
Thank you, Roland, Dom and Francis, for your questions. Thank you so much, Sean, for answering all of our questions. Let's go to our final thoughts. Sean, we'll come to you at last. So, Roland or Dom, would you like to go first?
I'm just referring back to what I was mentioning earlier, really. I really think that going forward into this year, this spring, Kharkiv really is something to look at. It's vulnerable. I was there in the first days of the war, and I remember the sense of uncertainty when the Russians tried to surround it last time. So I'm just kind of making a mental note of that to keep my attention on that in the coming months, and I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Roland. Dom Nichols.
Yeah, thanks, David. I mean, it seems a bit trite now to have say what I was going to say for final thoughts. I'll just leave it as, have a look at what Lukashenko's up today at the Suvalki Gap, making some noises that will be good for Putin. He's desperate to get back in his good books, having dropped the ball yesterday by saying the Crocus attackers tried to get into Belarus rather than go straight for Ukraine. So have a look at what Lukashenko's up to. But actually, what I want to say is, Sean, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your words. I think, not putting words in your mouth at all, but it sounds as if the weight is getting a little bit easier for you to bear. I don't think you'll ever get rid of it, but hopefully it's now just a pebble that you can kick around at your leisure. But Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Roland. Thank you, Dom. Francis Sternley.
Thanks, David. I just want to echo what Dom said there. Some of the most extraordinary testimony I think we've heard on 2 years of the podcast. Thank you very much, Sean. And I, for one, will certainly be reading your book. And I'll add a link in the show notes to it, because I think there's a lot more to unpack. And it'd be great to have you on in a future episode. Just very, very briefly, we've talked about war crimes today. We did a piece yesterday in The Telegraph by Geoffrey Robertson, president of the UN's War Crimes Court in Sierra Leone and author of a new book called The Trial of Vladimir Putin. And he makes an argument very persuasively, I think, in this article, which again we'll add in the show notes, that Putin can and should be tried in absentia. So even though it's not looking likely in the short term there'll be a Nuremberg trial, he argues very persuasively that there are reasons why there should be a public trial of what is going on. So I will point listeners to that. And just the other thing, Monday's episode will be a special from me looking at a very specific cultural issue in Ukraine. And the Ukrainian Institute of London is hosting a documentary season at the moment called People Power, showcasing four documentary films dedicated to modern Ukrainian society. We'll add a link in the show notes to that. Even if you're not in London, it links and describes some very, very interesting documentaries, including one called Iron Butterflies, about the impact of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 and how that was really a warning of the direction of travel that Ukraine and Russia were going in. And unfortunately, it was one that was ignored. But as I say, some links there we'll add in the show notes. And thank you again, Sean, for your fascinating testimony.
Thank you, Francis. Sean, would you like the very final words?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about hope. As a military man, it's hard to put hope and luck. You wouldn't put that in any plan, as Dom says before. But there's so many things I'd like to say in my final thought, but I think I would like to raise the importance of continuing to have hope, is that it's really being tested right now for us in Ukraine. And the awareness of those that are still captured and held in captivity by Russia, especially those of my friends whose fate is still unknown after 2 years and are still parted from their family members, their children and loved ones. I talk regularly with one such mum of a soldier I was captain with. We comfort each other on his future and hopeful exchange, like many other families. We text each other when we hear the exchange is taking place, and then we're picking each other up once we hear isn't on the list. When you've had every shred of decency ripped from you, like when you're in captivity, sometimes hope is all you have left. And it is an underrated feeling, because hope gives you something to fight for, really. Hope helps you remain positive, and hope helps keep the faith. Hope gives you a reason not to give up, and hope can lead you to do amazing things. We can't ever lose hope in Ukrainian victory, and that all the prisoners will eventually be returned. We can never lose hope. Where will we be as a country and people if we don't have it? Hope. And thank you for having me on.
Sean Pinner, thank you so much for your time. Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.